Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. Welcome to our very first Get Lit with All of It book club. Ladies and gentlemen of the Get Lit with All of It book club, you've spent all month reading her latest novel along with us as part of our very first book club. No one in this room can deny that Laura Lippman is the queen of mystery. She's achieved acclaim for her Tess Monahan novels, and her previous standalone book, Sunburn, was one of the hottest books of 2018. But before she became a crime novelist, did you know that Laura Lippman spent 20 years as a journalist? And she put those years of experience to good use in Lady in the Lake. Set in 1960s Baltimore, the novel centers around two women who have more in common than one might think. Our main narrator is the newly liberated housewife, Maddie Morgenstern, who turns her life upside down in order to make a name for herself as a journalist. And the case she just won't let go, the murder of a black woman, Cleo Sherwood, who Maddie dubs the Lady in the Lake. And as Maddie continues to dig around Cleo's past, we hear from the ghost of the Lady in the Lake herself, who is not that happy with Maddie's investigation. Sometimes Cleo argues it's just better to leave things alone. Lady in the Lake defies all expectations of a crime novel in true Laura Lippman fashion, and here to tell us about it herself is Laura Lippman. All right, we're gonna get into it, Laura. Okay. This group has been reading along, our whole staff has been reading along. I thought it was so interesting to learn that this is based on two real life stories.
Yes.
Tell us about these real life stories.
So, to sort of explain, I mean, I started off knowing only that I wasn't in 2017, writing about the present day suddenly seemed impossible. I felt that we had entered an era, and that's not a partisan opinion. It's like we had entered this era in which everything was at once extremely frenetic and extremely static. I felt like every friend I had just ran back and forth between their laptop and the TV and like, this will change everything. And the next day, nothing had changed. And here we are. So I was like, I can't write about the present right now. I don't know what I want to say about the times we're living in. I'm going to need some time to think about that. And I began looking toward the past. And I was initially drawn to 1966 because there was an election in Maryland, the governor's race, which had a lot of parallels with the presidential race of 2016. And then as I went back for it, I thought, yeah, I don't want to write a political novel, Evelyn. I don't want to write about a governor's race. But I knew about these two deaths that actually occurred in 1969. And one of them in real life was the death of an 11-year-old girl named Esther Leibowitz. And because I was the daughter of a newspaper man, because I was probably already planning to grow up to be a journalist, I had read everything about that case when I was 10 years old. You know, like that weird little kid with the afternoon newspaper. And so I knew everything about that case. I knew that a girl had disappeared, that her body was found, a man had been charged and convicted of her murder. But there was a death of a woman named Shirley Parker, and I never heard a word about it until I went to work at the Baltimore Sun more than 20 years later. And Shirley Parker's body had been found in the lake, same year. And her disappearance was not news. And the discovery of her body was probably only news because of the mystery of where she was found. How did she get there? What happened? Because there was never an official ruling in her death. They never determined the cause of death, so they couldn't rule it a homicide. If she'd been found in an alley or the trunk of somebody's car, she might not have even been a news story. And that seemed to be a very interesting contrast to me. But how do you bring those two stories together? Mm-hmm. And one could create like some vast conspiracy in which the deaths were literally connected. But instead I thought, I have to create a character who somehow would be connected to both of these deaths. She is the connection, and that's where Maddie came from.
And listeners, I just want to make sure everybody knows there could be spoilers in this conversation. We're not aiming for them, but it could happen. You've been warned.
If you haven't finished, it's on you.
Well done. So in the writing process, as you're writing a novel that's purely from your imagination versus one that's based on two real life stories, how is the writing process different then?
It's not as different as you might think. When I'm often inspired by real life stories, and I'm very careful. I never say things are ripped from the headlines. To me, that suggests something kind of sloppy and careless. I'm inspired by real life stories, but I'm inspired by thematic things. You know, in this case, it was a little white girl died and everybody knew about it. An African-American woman in her 20s died and no one seemed to know and no one seemed to care. And I really couldn't see that 2019 was that different from 1966. And I think we're kidding ourselves if we think it is. So I was drawn to those ideas. Once I've identified real life cases that are of interest to me, I do no research. I want to know as little about them as possible. I don't want real life to take over. So now I'm off on my own. And I find that I'm really willing to take liberties with a lot of the public record. You know, it's not a real story. And it's not a famous story. Like, if you're going to write a novel that was inspired by the kidnapping of the Lindbergh baby, you do have to kind of hew closer to the record because that's a known story. It's already in the public imagination. Most people had never heard of either of these cases. I mean, people in Baltimore were familiar somewhere. My own mother, by the way, told me, said, "Laura, did you realize that I worked with Esther Leibowitz's father?" I'm like, no.
No.
Didn't know that. Wow. That was something my mom told me after the book was published. So, yeah, I felt. But what was very different about this book is I decided to put some real people in it. You know, not many, but there are these characters that pass by fleetingly in the book. The first African-American police officer, who was in fact a woman, known as Lady Law. That was a real character. And there's a brief chapter told from the point of view of Baltimore Orioles center fielder Paul Blair. And I just felt like, well, they should be in there. I just, you know, they're part of 1966. They're part of the story.
What was it about 1960s Baltimore that you wanted all of us, the reader, to know? And something that you wanted us to know that helped us understand these characters and their lives?
You know what, when people write about the 60s, I think the tendency has been, certainly there have been other books written in the mid-60s, but for the most part, when the 60s enter the public imagination, it's often the early 60s because the Kennedy assassination is so often portrayed as, you know, America's lost innocence. And then we look at 68 and 69, which are these years of enormous upheaval and everything is changing. Having just wandered into 66 almost by happenstance, I became fascinated with it. It's a real hinge year. It's funny because I'm literally working on my taxes now because my husband and I don't file until October 15th. We needed an extension. And I saw this very day, I saw an entry, and I was like, that's when I bought, in February of 2018, I bought a book called 1966 at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame bookstore in Cleveland, where I was on book tour for my previous book. And the book 1966 tells the story of the year through the number one singles. And it's a fascinating
That's
book.
So
it's
cool.
A terrific book. It was published, I think, by Faber and Faber out of the UK. And one of the details that jumped out at me, it's the author's observation, is that this is a year in which, at the beginning of the year, one of the number one singles is King of the Road by Roger Miller. And by the end of the year, one of the number one singles in the United States will be Satisfaction by the Rolling Stones. That's an interesting year. That's a culture that's changing quickly and changing rapidly. And I was like, this is a hinge year. This is like, maybe we don't think of 1966. I mean, it's also, then I'm just there and I find out, you know, it's before Loving, the case that will make interracial marriage legal in the United States. It is literally the year that the Baltimore City Police Department will become integrated under a new commissioner. At the beginning of 1966, black police officers in Baltimore They could be patrolmen. They could be vice undercover. They weren't allowed in patrol cars. They weren't allowed to have radios. And all of that's going to change by the end of 66 when a new commissioner comes in and starts fast-tracking the integration of the department. And it was just like detail after detail. Just, you know, once you sort of pick a year. I mean, I'm a big fan of the writer Bill Bryson. I'm also a big fan of Gene Weingarten of the Washington Post, who this year published a book called One Day, where he just told stories that happened about a single arbitrary day that was determined by having kids like draw dates out of a hat in a bar. And Bill Bryson did this amazing book called One Summer, which is the history of the summer of 1927, which is the year of Lindbergh's flight. And it's when you focus closely enough on a year, a place, you will find amazing stories.
I was getting the chills, if I can tell you, because I was born in 1966. Oh. So I'm thinking about my parents, and my sister's 10 years older than I am. So I'm thinking about my parents having a 10-year-old and then bringing another child into the world in this year you just described, what it must have been like for a young black couple at that time.
It's a really scary. Another thing, too, is that as you start reading the newspapers, you realize once again, and this is where you see this parallel between now and then, the people who are most at risk of violence and crime are African Americans. You know, sort of that there's this exaggerated white fear of mugging. Mm-hmm. And like these stories like, oh, and you know, literally the Baltimore Sun would have a story about a woman getting her purse snatched. But who is actually at risk? Who is actually, you know, and more there were stories about the violence in inner cities and who was being affected by that. It was black people.
My guest is Laura Lippman. The name of the book is Lady in the Lake. It was our first choice for our Get Lit with All of It book club. Let's talk about our protagonist, Maddie. So Maddie's a bit of a polarizing narrator. We did an Instagram poll. I don't know if you saw this.
No.
So we've been on Instagram stories having polls and putting up factoids about the book.
Picked a bad month to strip my phone down. Sorry about that.
Okay, so we asked the poll. More than half of those who responded said they found Maddie to be an unsympathetic character. So it's right down the middle. Here, how many people found Maddie to be kind of unlikable?
It's fine.
Okay, it's about half and half. What do you think about that, first of all?
I'm not surprised by it at all. I've been asked a lot about my relationship to Maddie. And I've been very frank in saying, Maddie's the person that I fear I could have become. Maddie is a newspaper reporter, which is something I was, or wants to be. She wants to tell a story, and she's so focused on the story she wants to tell that she's utterly incurious about the people that she meets. I mean, I still kind of like her. There's something about her, and I feel that when you see her at the end of the book, this is kind of I think this is sort of a funny story. I was talking to a Hollywood person who was interested in the book, and he mansplained the end of my own book to me. And one of the things he said, it's Maddie's story is tragic. And I said, really? And I guess we're sort of in spoiler category territory here. I won't be too specific. I said, I mean, this is a book about a time when the choice between love and work could be pretty stark. Sort of the point of the book, that women have to make choices, and the concept of having it all isn't even articulated. I said, I think Maddie is okay with her choices. I think Maddie's fine with where she ended up. And I sort of admire that about her. I mean, she's not likable. By the way, Maddie wouldn't be my friend. Maddie has almost no use for women. I mean, she is one of those incredibly feminine creatures who has spent her entire life depending on men and cultivating. I mean, that's literally a line in the novel. I'm going to cultivate the men, after she has a bad run-in with a female colleague at the newspaper. She's like, oh, women are no good anyway. I'll cultivate the men. So no, she's not particularly likable. You know, I teach writing, and my students are eager to publish. And sometimes the first reaction they get to their novels is, well, your character isn't likable. And I said, yeah, when an editor tells you that, it's like someone telling you that they can't go out on Saturday night because they need to wash their hair. They don't really know what to say. It's not about likable. Is your character interesting? Mm-hmm. Is your character charismatic? I mean, Hannibal Lecter isn't likable, but people have shown that they want to spend time in his company. So I think, no, Maddie's not particularly likable, but I think she's pretty interesting.
My guest is Laura Lippman. The name of the book is Lady in the Lake. It was our first choice for our Get Lit with All of It book club. This is All of It on WNYC. We'll be right back. All of It on WNYC. We are back. I've been speaking with author Laura Lippman about her new novel, Lady in the Lake, which was our first book club choice for Get Lit with All of It. What about having the ghost of Cleo, narrate part of this book? When did that become clear to you that that needed to happen?
I realized very early on that since I was writing a book that was essentially a commentary on a woman who was incurious, on a woman who, as Cleo the ghost herself would say, isn't interested in Cleo's life, she's interested in Cleo's death, and they're not the same thing, that Cleo had to be the first and last voice in the book, that she had to bookend the book, and that as a crime writer in general, it's really important to me that the victims not just be MacGuffins, devices to create a story. The other day, I watched an older, kind of cheesy movie called Malice with Alec Baldwin and Nicole Kidman. I don't think people remember it. Well, the thing that struck me is there are three female college students who are killed toward the beginning of this film. And the only reason, though, those murders happen is because there needs to be a reason for the police department to collect a semen sample from Bill Pullman, because that's really important to the plot. So in other words, three co-eds have been horribly killed just for a plot point. And even though one of them is Gwyneth Paltrow, I don't think that's right. You know, but it's like, there should be, the people who die in crime novels should matter. You just don't want this big old pile of bodies sitting over there so that the tough, gruff detective can learn to have a little more sympathy and maybe go home and hug his daughter. It's like, dude, there's still 17 dead prostitutes. Mm-hmm. No, so it really is important to me that victims have a voice, that they live in the book. And in this case, I gave a dead woman a literal voice. And I knew really early on that Cleo not only had to be a voice in the novel, she in some ways had to be the voice. She had to dominate it in a way. And I would hope that people do find Cleo likable, but maybe I'm wrong about that.
What do Cleo and Maddie have in common?
Well, they're both beautiful. And they both are used to using their beauty to get what they want. They don't necessarily want the same things, but they are aware that they are living in a man's world and that they both just accept that. They don't fight against it. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, this is the world I was born into. These are the rules. I'll do what I have to do to get what I want. And I think that's primarily it. But Cleo has very different values from Maddie. They want very different things and they choose very different things.
My guest is Laura Lippman. We're talking about her book, Lady in the Lake. Our audience is going to get a chance to ask questions in a little bit. I've got a couple more. Something we were talking about, we were sitting around talking about the book, because we actually do that, this team. And we were talking about Maddie just sort of inserting herself in places. And it reminded us of all these true crime podcasts. Did you ever see that joke on Saturday Night Live about white women going places they shouldn't be award?
Yeah.
like I am with the drug cartel and I'm, you know, getting the audio of the tires. I was sort of interested in why was she so willing to just put herself in any situation, to your point, kind of regardless of what it meant to anybody else.
She can't even imagine the havoc that she wreaks in other people's life. I mean, Maddie is so spoiled and so entitled, it's never really occurred to her that anything bad could happen to her. And, you know, part of this is, it's a reason that there's this backstory about Maddie, about something that happened to her when she was a teenager, something that, had things turned out slightly differently, could have ruined her life. But it didn't. And I think that has made her feel a little bit bulletproof. And so, I mean, she's sometimes conscious of, this is a bad neighborhood, this is a little bit tricky, I'm a little bit uncomfortable there, but it just doesn't occur to her that she can't go where she wants, when she wants, and demand of people what she wants. I mean, it is the absolute nature of entitlement and privilege to like never question that she can be wherever she wants to be and it doesn't matter. You know, like no one, why would she not be able to, why can't I just show up at a psychic's house and knock on the door and ask questions? Why can't I just march up the front walk of, you know, this very dignified and lovely woman who has held it together in the wake of this murder investigation that, you know, her husband is sort of rumored to somehow be connected to. Maddie doesn't ever think about anyone else's feelings.
You mentioned earlier Loving versus Virginia, and at this time as you write this, interracial marriage was illegal.
Right.
What did you want to explore about an interracial relationship, and what kind of things did you have to ask and sort of ruminate on to make sure you got that tone right?
You know, the main thing I wanted to explore about Maddie's relationship is that while the fact that it's interracial might be the thing that was uppermost in other people's minds, Maddie is a snob. And the main reason that she likes having this secret relationship has as much to do with the fact that Ferdy is a cop as it does with the fact that he's black. Like, Maddie wants a secret. She had a husband. She's done that. She likes having a lover who comes and goes, who's not making any demands on her, who realistically cannot make any demands on her. She finds it thrilling. But the real problem for Maddie is that she cannot see herself as someone who would have a serious relationship with a police officer. Just like, you know, no. It's, you know, she's an upper middle class lady. And it would never occur to her to be with a man who doesn't make more money and can't provide a certain lifestyle.
How long did it take you to write this book?
This book took about, well, it's a sad fact that I know to the day when I finished this book. I started this book in February of 2017, and I finished it on June 27th, 2018, with a major revision that came after that. But that was the day that I submitted it to my editor and my agent.
That was going to be my next question. We had Ann Patchett on last week, and she, in her new book, The Dutch House, is great. But she said she wrote almost a whole book and then realized it was a hot mess. And she threw it away. She said, I took a wrong turn early on in my draft. I just took a wrong turn. How do you know? Do you have that internal censor about, the past week has been not useful?
I mean, this is tricky. This is the one point where some certain parts, I'm not a normally superstitious person, okay, but I'm not someone who's ever going to claim that I always know what I'm doing. I have been doing this for a long time. I have written more than 20 books. And so what I tell myself is, you've survived it this many times before, you'll survive it again. I do think I have a pretty good instinct for when things aren't working. And I'm really okay with sort of tearing my book back down to the foundation and starting over. And I don't consider that wasted time, and I don't feel bad about it. I think that might be my newspaper background. You know how it is in news. You get things just get torn apart, and you start over, and editors have their way with things, and you start over. So this book, once I sort of found the pattern that I wanted, which was this idea that we would see a scene through Maddie's point of view and then see it from the point of view of the other person in the scene, it would be very different. Once I discovered that, that helped a lot. But it was an intense time. I just happened on an old journal where I was like, I wrote, I've got 3 months to turn my book in. I think maybe I can do it. So that's where I was like in April of 2018, like maybe, hope so.
That's why you had to get the extension on the taxes. So we don't want to spoil the ending for anyone who isn't quite done yet, but Stephen King, who reviewed your book in the New York Times, wrote, Lippman answers all outstanding questions with a totally cool double twist that your reviewer, a veteran reader of mysteries, never saw coming. So I don't want to spoil it. How do you master making twists that are both believable and unpredictable?
I'm almost hesitant to answer this because I feel like I'm giving away one of my state secrets, okay. But... So the way to surprise readers is don't try that hard to surprise them. I'm a really big believer in, I call it, Occam's razor. I set up this situation and I think, what would be logical? What is the most reasonable explanation for what's going on? And I'm very conscious of the fact that people who read crime fiction, they're super smart. They will do a lot of the heavy lifting for you, because they're used to reading this kind of fiction in which anything potentially could be relevant, could be a clue. So their minds are racing along, 90 miles an hour, like, what about this? What about that? Does that matter? 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 And they're making it more complicated than it is. So I often find by having a reveal that when you think about it, it's like, oh, well, of course that's what was happening. Of course that's the answer. And I think I learned this from my father in an indirect way. He had read one of my books and he said, boy, did that ending surprise me. I could have sworn that somebody else is going to turn out to have been the person who was responsible for what happened in chapter one. And I said, but I told you in chapter one who did it. And he said, I didn't believe you. So it's like, okay then. I sort of realized that there's this, we talk about entertainment being interactive as if that's a new concept, but reading has always been interactive. Reading has always been something that depends on a person picking up a book and really immersing themselves. I mean, it's much different to read a book than it is to watch the best television show, the best film. And I know there's all this great TV now, and it can be complicated and hard to follow, and it encourages people to have all these theories. But there's still something really special about the relationship between a reader and a book.
My guest is Laura Lippman. We've been talking about her new novel, The Lady in the Lake. Coming up next, we will take some questions from the audience. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All of It on WNYC. We are back. I've been speaking with author Laura Lippman about her new novel, Lady in the Lake, which was our first book club choice for Get Lit with All of It. We have a live studio audience here. We've got questions from the audience, from our book club members. Who wants to ask a question?
Hi, thanks so much for all the background that you provided tonight about the year 1966 and the racial backdrop to really give even more context than you provided in the book, which was rich in the book as well. And one aspect that I'm curious to hear more about from you tonight is Maddie's Jewish upbringing and the fact that it didn't really seem to have much bearing on her in her adult life, but certainly factored prominently for both Tessie and Maddie's background.
Great. Well, one other inspiration for this book was Marjorie Morningstar, which is a book I love and had read many, many times over. The past few books I've written have sort of had this secondary agenda in which I'm exploring a classic novel that I love. I wrote a book called Wild Lake, which basically imagined the events of To Kill a Mockingbird if they'd occurred in a liberal suburb in 1980? How would the story have played out there? Sunburn was my homage to James Cane. What happens if the mysterious drifter passing through town is a beautiful woman instead of a man? And then I started thinking about Marjorie Morningstar, a book I love and a book, you know, not a lot of people read anymore. Herman Woke just died this year at the age of, I believe, 103. And he had this really interesting career where he wrote lots of, you know, he wrote this big war saga. He wrote a book that Jimmy Buffett attempted to turn into a musical. I mean, he wrote about the super collider in Texas. So he had this one novel about a young Jewish girl in New York in the 1930s who wanted to become an actress and made a mistake of sleeping with the wrong man, and it almost ruined her life. And there's a scene at the end of the book where he turns point of view over to the boy who yearned after Marjorie and could never get her, and he sees her and he just tells the story of seeing her as a happily married woman. And I thought, I wonder what Marjorie's view of that story is. And I thought about the way that you see someone from your past and it can bring all of this stuff up. My character, her Jewishness is of a type that would have been pretty common in mid-century Baltimore, where people would have sort of gone through the motions of being kosher, except they're really not. A couple of people have written my editor and they've pointed out that Maddie's not really kosher. And I'm like, yeah, I know. That's sort of the joke, that she's pretending to keep a kosher kitchen for Milton, but she's actually breaking the dietary laws in all sorts of ways. And like, one of the stories that a friend of mine told me once about growing up Jewish in Baltimore was that it was okay to have crab feasts because you were outside eating on newspaper. Like, you know, obviously you wouldn't have to observe Jewish dietary law if you were outside eating off a newspaper. So Maddie represents that sort of Judaism, which is, it's more cultural than anything else. And for Milton, it's more important. And then for someone like Tessie, it's very important. She comes from a truly, so I kind of wanted to have all of those gradations of Jewishness in Baltimore in the 1950s and 60s. I guess I should explain, I was not brought up in the Jewish faith. My grandfather was the child of Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe who ended up in Montgomery, Alabama. And he just never really cared about it. He married into a Protestant family. And my father was raised as a Methodist. And my dad worked at the Baltimore Sun. And he worked alongside the man that I'm now married to. And David and I had dated for a long time when it came up. He's like, what do you mean your father's not Jewish? I'm like, well, he's just not, David. And he's like, he looks like a little old Jewish man. And I'm like, well, you try to explain that to him. You know, David had grown up with a father who worked for B'nai B'rith. So a lot of what I write about Judaism has sort of come to me through marriage. And, you know, I'm raising my daughter in a synagogue in Baltimore. So it's where our rabbi said, Laura, wasn't that our synagogue in your book? I'm like, yeah.
Thank you, Laura Lippman, for being here.
Wow. What an honor.
The name of the book is Lady in the Lake. Up next, a music performance from the trio Joseph. Stay with us. We'll be right back.